Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2021 podcast series, which is supported by the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund.
Good evening, everyone. It's my very great pleasure to welcome you to this Melbourne Writers Festival session with Stan Grant, Henry Reynolds and Thomas Mayer. First of all, let me begin by acknowledging the country where I am. I'm in Naarm, or Melbourne, on the country of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people, and I pay my respects to the traditional owners and especially to the elders past and present. So the session is entitled Uncomfortable Truths from Unceded Lands, and this is a topic that our three speakers are very familiar with. So could I begin by introducing our writers to you? What a treat to have Stan Grant with us. I'm a huge fan. So Stan is a Wiradjuri and Gamilaroi man. He's been a journalist since 1987. He's worked for the ABC, SBS, the Seven Network and Sky News Australia, also CNN as an anchor and senior correspondent in Asia and the Middle East. As a journalist, he's received a string of prestigious international and Australian awards. In 2015, he published his best-selling book, Talking to My Country, which won the Walkley Book Award. His other books include The Tears of Strangers and, most recently, With the Falling of the Dusk. He's also contributed many articles to major Australian newspapers, magazines and journals. He was born in Griffith, and The Tears of Strangers is an extraordinary account of his life. But I think it's fair to say, and I certainly hold this view, he's one of Australia's most respected and awarded journalists. I'm a big fan of China Tonight, for instance. He's interviewed the greats, including Nelson Mandela and many others, many Australian prime ministers as well. I won't go through the long list of
No, we don't need that.
but you can look at those online. So a huge warm welcome to you, Stan.
Lovely to be here.
Now, Thomas is an extraordinary character. He's a Torres Strait Islander man born on Larrakia country in Darwin. Now, his publisher's biographical notes tell us more about him. As an islander growing up on the mainland, he learned to hunt traditional foods with his father and to island dance in the Darwin community of Torres Strait Islanders. His high school teacher suggested he could become a writer. He didn't think then that he would become one of the first ever Torres Strait Islander authors to have a book published for the general trade. He became a wharf labourer from the age of 17 and eventually a union official for the Maritime Union of Australia in his early 30s, and he remains in that post. So he's found his voice in a range of books, first of all with Finding the Heart of the Nation, The Journey of the Uluru Statement Towards Voice, Treaty and Truth. He published a version of that for young people, followed by another book for young people, Freedom Day, Vincent Lingiari and the Story of the Wave Hill Walk-Off. His latest book, Dear Son, Letters and Reflections from First Nations Fathers and Sons, brings together letters from Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander men to their sons and fathers about life, love, culture, racism and masculinity, about how to be proud of themselves, to be better men, and to raise better men. Along with his own prose and poetry, he invited Stan Grant, Troy Cassadaly, John Little, Charlie King, Joe Williams, Yessie Mosby, Joel Bayliss, Daniel James, Jack Lattimore, Daniel Morrison, Tim Sculthorpe and Black Douglas to contribute letters, and they all did. So I look forward to discussing your book with you.
Thank you, Marcy.
I'm trying to remember when I first met Henry. I know it was in the 80s sometime. I went to his book launch in Townsville of, I believe it was the other side of the frontier. I've been a fan ever since. He is one of Australia's most recognised historians. He grew up in Hobart and was educated at Hobart High School and the University of Tasmania. In 1965, he accepted a lectureship at James Cook University in Townsville, which sparked an interest in the history of relations between settlers and Aboriginal people. He took up a professorial fellowship at the University of Tasmania in 2000. Now, throughout his long career, he has not stopped publishing books. I'll just name a few of the titles. I've mentioned The Other Side of the Frontier, What's Wrong with Anzac, Forgotten War, Unnecessary Wars, Aboriginal Sovereignty, This Whispering in Our Hearts, and a sequel to that book. And recently two more books to add to a growing pile, Truth Telling, History, Sovereignty and the Uluru Statement, and with Nicholas Clements, Tonga Wangata, First Nations Leader and Tasmanian War Hero. So a very warm welcome to you, Henry.
So, thank you, Marty.
Because of your seniority, Henry, I'm going to put the first question to you. Henry, your book, Truth Telling, is a ripper. I see that you have named several of the colonial governors and leaders who effectively authorised murder. And then you go on to explain that there are two different periods, and in the latter period things got worse, not better. And you name, for instance, Griffiths.
Yep.
And I think that's an incredibly important point that you make. And you talk about the Northern Frontier and people on that Northern Frontier like Forrest and Downer and Griffiths. Mm. So you draw our attention to the relevance of these historical issues to our predicament in Australia today, having at the very beginning of the book published the Uluru Statement from the Heart in full, and you address that statement in a most interesting way throughout. So please tell me more about, well, you've got a long experience of Queensland, Griffiths, the character Griffiths, and, you know, why are we, what are we doing honouring this man and given his appalling record?
Well, what struck me was that when Australia began to look at the situation in parallel with what was happening in other parts of the world, particularly in South and North America and removing statues, also obviously now in Britain and South Africa, and Australia directed their attention at those people in the very earliest period. I mean, Cook and Phillip and Macquarie, and yet this isn't the part of the story which is so incredibly important to us, and that is the period after the British gave power to the colonies, and they were doing this from 1850. Now, in 1850, when power was passing to the colonists themselves, there were only about 12,000 Europeans in North Australia. There were 4,000 in Western Australia, 8,000 in Queensland, and none in the Territory. So the whole settlement of this vast area of North Australia, still with very large Aboriginal populations, that became the scene for the second phase of colonisation. Now, this was much more complicated. Now, it's much closer to us. It is important because this was done not by the British, but by the elected colonial parliaments, often elected by manhood suffrage. This is our war. This is far more so than the early colonial period. And therefore, I just think we, partly because so few of the people who write really have lived in the North, have looked at Australia from the North down. And so you've got this, in particular, Queensland. Queensland, after all, when it gained self-government, there was a vast area of Queensland that was virtually untouched. And it was the Queensland experience, which I think is so important. And at the centre of this is Samuel Walker Griffiths. In Parliament from the early 70s till the 1890s, he was either the Premier or the Attorney General for most of those years. And this was the period when the Native Mounted Police were going around the frontier and probably undoubtedly killing hundreds of people. Now, this was extrajudicial killing. It wasn't, you know, war hadn't been declared. These people in theory were British subjects. And Griffiths, I mean, many of the frontiersmen thought, oh, that's just the way things are. But Griffiths was a great jurist. He knew that this was quite outside the law. And remember, he became, having been a senior politician, he became the Chief Justice of Queensland, and then he was the founding Chief Justice of the High Court until 1919. So therefore, if we're going to concentrate in one period and one person in particular, that's where we must look. And that's where we've got to do a great deal of reconsideration of how we deal with our history.
Yes, yeah, so we have Griffith University, the Griffith Review, the suburb of Griffith in Canberra.
The Samuel Griffith Society.
Yes, indeed.
Yes, absolutely. And I also just found out very recently that it was Griffiths who put in the clause in the Constitution that Aborigines weren't to be counted. At the very last stage of that conference in 1891, and then that ends up in our Constitution until 1957. So this is, this is so much more important to us than looking at Macquarie and Cook and Phillip and the early governors, because this is so much closer to us. And as you remarked, those three, Griffiths, Downer and Forrest, all became, you know, knights of the realm. They were all foundation fathers, and they are all celebrated. They all, for instance, they all have Canberra suburbs named after them. So it's all very easy to say, oh, John Batman, he was a rogue, let's take his name away from things. But this was very, very tiny compared to what was happening later, 50 years later, across North Australia.
So we'll return to this topic, and I hope that members of the audience, and we now have 139 people in the audience, will ask questions. And it's my job to keep an eye on the questions. No questions as yet. Please enter your questions in the Q&A. So we'll return to this issue. Stan, it's wonderful to be able to talk to you. Now, I was taken with something that you wrote in on identity. Mm. And I see that you've been grappling with how to, you know, deal with Australian history and all of the problems that it raises, especially for us as Indigenous people. But you don't give us any easy answers. So if you don't mind, I'll just read something.
Yeah.
Put two or more of us together, and it is the first question asked. Where are you from? Who are your people? It is genealogy, but it is more than that. It is survival. We all do this in our own way, people everywhere. It is the family crest, the clan's tartan, a sepia-tinged photograph, a convict ship's manifest, a long-dead soldier's pocketbook, the tattooed wrists of the death camps, tangible proof because we so need it. But then in your book, Australia Day, you say we all seek identity, which communities we belong to, which football club we follow, what music we like, how we dress, and so on. All of this gives us a sense of who we are, somewhere to belong. But there is a darker side to identity, a stifling conformity, an us and them, identity that pits us against each other. It keeps returning me to that question, am I Australian? Am I Aboriginal? Can those things be the same? So we have this reckoning with the historical past that forces us to ask the questions that you've asked in the most clever way.
It's a tension, isn't it? And it's a tension that lives in us and the names that we give to things. You know, who belongs, who gets to belong, how we define people. You know, Marcia, our lives have been shaped by the definitions of other people. Half caste, quarter caste, blood, you know, blood quantum measurements of ourselves, our white and black forebears who were not allowed to marry each other. My grandmother, a white grandmother, living with a black man who could not have her children in the hospital because they would not allow her to, you know, and these things sit uneasily within me, and I wrestle with these things all the time. You know, when we use this word Australia, and just to reflect on what Henry was talking about there, the complicity in the birth of Australia with the subjugation of our people and the idea that we would be measured against some Australian ideal that was never designed to include us. As Henry says, we were not counted. We were deliberately not counted. So the whole idea for me of who am I what does it mean to be Aboriginal when that was never a label that we put on ourselves? We were Gumbleroy and Wiradjuri people, Yorta Yorta people, and wherever we were from. What is this label Australian when we know that we were told very clearly and very loudly that we were not Australian? You know, they are very vexed issues. And as I've travelled throughout the world and, you know, reported that the conflicts of our time, whether it be in across the Middle East or Iraq or Afghanistan, Pakistan, my years in China, I was confronted everywhere by the legacy of history, how we deal with history or how we do not deal with history, and how that shapes our identities in ways that can be increasingly toxic. You know, when the historical record is not confronted, when the stories are not told, when the voices are not heard, the resentment and the grievance and the vengeance festers, it lingers. Where there is not justice, there is the seeds of conflict grow. We only need to look around our world today and you look at the way that people frame their identities or the way that those identities are expressed, often around a sense of historical grievance. Xi Jinping talks about the 100 years of humiliation that burns so deeply in the Chinese soul. We hear Vladimir Putin talk about the collapse of the Soviet Union as the great catastrophe of the 20th century. Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Turkey still laments the fall of the Ottoman Empire. And, you know, these things shape who we are. And where there is not an account, where there is not an ability to grapple with those things, that paradox can really tear at ourselves and who we are. And, you know, I wrestle with this all the time, to live with the weight of history and yet to try to live free of the chains of history. They are really tough questions for us to answer.
Mm-hmm. Now, I see also you've raised another layer in your new book, with the Falling of the Dusk, where your role as a journalist across the world makes you also a global citizen.
Yeah.
A very cosmopolitan Australian.
Yeah.
With a deep understanding of the wars elsewhere and the global issues that confront us all. The environmental crisis, media ownership, our trade agreements. And you are at once saying, you know, well, they say we're all in it together, but we're not. And yet you come out of it looking like the ever the optimist. So
it's again, you know, it's when you have walked those sort of fault lines of our world, you know, when you have seen that these things that divide us, these things that fester, have real consequences. You know, when you have stood in the bloodied marketplaces, as I have, when you have seen what war can do, when you look into the eyes of refugees in Iraq or Afghanistan or Pakistan and see your own family looking back at you, because we know that look, we know what that looks like, to lose certainty, that your place in the world, we know what that looks like. And then beyond that, what gives us the capacity to endure, to go on? Where does the optimism come from that we know that our ancestors drew upon? You know, where does my father, who has lived a life at the coalface of bigotry and racism in Australia, who's our own families that are shaped by the very history that Henry writes about, where do you find the generosity of spirit to revive our language, to teach that language, not just for us, but as a gift to the country? Where do people who talk in the Uluru Statement about the march for a better country find that incredible generosity of spirit? You know, Eddie Mabo did not fight all the way to the High Court just for the people of Mur, but for all of us, Indigenous and non-Indigenous people, to truly reckon with the question of our history and who we are and how we share this country. You know, I've walked all of those fault lines and I've wrestled with those things. You know, optimism, you know, I'm often reminded of the words, I think, of W.E.B. Du Bois, who once said that he believes in a hope that is hopeless and yet hopeful. hopeless and yet hopeful. That so fits so many of the people that I've encountered here amongst my own people and in travelling the world. And that cosmopolitanism that you talk about, that ability to know that as an Indigenous person, as a Wiradjuri Gamilaroi person, that I am free to be that person in the world with all of its complexity and contradiction, to be free to shape that myself without the imposition of others. You know, those things have kept me on that quest to keep reading, keep thinking, keep looking at the world and trying to grapple with how we live together with all of this difference and the weight of this history on this planet.
Thank you, Stan. Thomas, your book of letters by yourself and your contributors to Sons and Fathers, like, you know, I think this is the big challenge. And obviously you've come to the same conclusion in such a very clear way, I think. How do we pass on to our children this legacy that Stan has just talked about and which, you know, Henry has written so much about? How do we have that difficult discussion with our children? How do you talk to your son about this and yet make him a better man given this horrific history that Henry has detailed so well over so many decades?
I think it goes somewhat to what Stan mentioned there, you know, Du Bois and, you know, feeling hopeless and yet hopeful. Another way to describe that, I suppose, is to learn from the mistakes from the past and do better. And really that's what, you know, I've tried to do with Dear Son, this book, this collection of letters from fathers to sons and sons to fathers, is to be honest about many of us in the book, you know, talk about the mistakes that we've made as parents, you know, and as men, and how we think, you know, we can improve. But that goes to the entirety of Australia, right? You know, this... there's been so much truth-telling already being done, though, I think is a great, you know, point to make. All the wonderful work that both Henry and Stan has done over a very long time, yourself, the truth is certainly out there. I thought it really interesting how we talk about how, you know, how nations and civilizations basically come and go in the world and, you know, and disappear. And I think the question... And this goes to more what we can do for our children, you know, a platform or a better place that we can make for them before they reach adulthood and so they have somewhere to step up to, is we need to look to the Constitution, because you can describe it as the DNA of a nation, right? It's what shapes how we grow and how we behave and how our politicians can make decisions. I think we are a nation stuck in the past. And, you know, I think it's time to improve that, you know, as per the Uluru Statement, as Stan mentioned as well.
So there are some interesting questions, and perhaps I should read them out so that you have an opportunity to answer them. So I'll read all of them out. How do we get these truths, not only the first phase but the second phase of colonisation, into the Australian school curriculum, so we tell the complete history and foster critical thinking in school students? Here's an interesting one from, excuse my pronunciation if I get it wrong, Nompumalelo Mpili. The celebration and veneration of the colonisers seems to have a relationship with the idea of Australian identity, at least for white people. Do you think that the continued defence of colonisers might actually be a way of continuing the colonial project as a form of soft colonisation, amplifying and justifying the stories of people who, if they had declared formal war, might have even been considered war criminals? Anonymous, do you see similarities between the experience of Indigenous Australians and those from other colonised countries, e.g. India, Malaysia, Burma? People from these countries also have complex identities who interact with Australia, the concept of Australia as a nation. Is Minister Wyatt helping the cause of truth-telling and assisting work towards changes to the constitution of his land now known as Australia? And then there's a question from a writer who's been unable to travel because of COVID-19. You're talking to me. Melbourne, 250 days, mate. I felt the frustrations of COVID travel restrictions, but it seems that the crucial purpose of crafting the work each of these authors has given us must be highly reliant on their ability to do this. And I wonder if we are facing an impending pause on the kind of stories, information, characters and perspectives they provide. So I think there's something for each of you there. Henry, your book, I think with Dr. Lake, The Global Colour Line, is that right?
Yep.
I think you could answer that question about, you know, Australian colonisation, and there are some significant differences that you point out, not only as compared with nearby colonies in our region, but with colonies like the United States and Canada where there are treaties.
Yeah. Yes, well, one of the things I wanted to do with truth-telling was to go back. I mean, invariably people say to you, look, yes, it was terrible, but that's just what they did in those days. And it's no good applying the standards of today and our human rights of the modern period backwards anachronistically to criticise the origins of white settlement. Now, what I want to do, because I've heard that so often, was to literally go back before the settlement and look at it as though one was coming towards it from the past. And there's no doubt that the British settlement of Australia was astonishingly inappropriate and illegal, the way they did it. And it was as bad as it could have been. And also in the earliest period, doing it with hundreds and hundreds of young single men and almost no women. I mean, how could that have succeeded? So that the British have a very great deal to answer for. So I think that, you know, we really have to see it in a way it was worse than most other places. And in a way it was the Australian experience, particularly the experience in Van Diemen's Land, that meant the British then went back to a more traditional way of making treaties and recognising property rights, which of course they did in New Zealand, and then even more significantly later in the Pacific with Fiji and Papua, where recognition of property rights has continued right through to the present. So that Australia was anomalous, and for the Indigenous people, they were far worse off from the way the British arrived. And after all, they arrived very quickly knowing nothing about it. And it's not surprising, therefore, that it was a mess. And it's left us with this extraordinary legacy still about the question of sovereignty. Because the Uluru Statement has these wonderful passages about the continuity of First Nation sovereignty and how it could continue and shine through, you know, to make us a more complete and whole society. But our law still is the law that the British designed in 1786. And our courts, our High Court says we can't change it. Now, that is astonishing. And it indicates, I think, just how we are still chained to the colonial legacy. And I haven't found anyone who can explain how we change it, except it could change when we have treaties. Because there's no point having treaties if the people, if the First Nations people come to the table with nothing to treat with, i.e. they have no sovereignty, they might be given a little bit. But the American and Canadian story, particularly modern Canada's modern treaties, is that they come with their sovereignty, their internal sovereignty, and that is part of what they can negotiate with. So we've got a long way to go, and this is partly as a result of the legacy, the legal legacy left to us by the British.
Can I just pick up a couple of things here that Henry's talked about as well, and that first question about the teaching of history and goes to the heart of the Australian project. You know, as Henry's outlined there, the assumptions of the completeness of the Australian project, that by planting a flag and annexing a country, claiming a country and extinguishing the rights of people, that that is a matter that is settled forever and a day. As Henry rightly points out, the High Court won't go there. It wouldn't go there in Mabo. It wouldn't disturb what's known as the skeleton of Australian law. And when the High Court gets close, as it did in Mabo, or recently in the Love decision as well, where it talked of a sense of belonging beyond the Australian law, beyond Australian citizenship. Again, when it takes us up to the point of giving some structure to sovereignty and inevitably then turns that over to the political class, to our parliaments, who just will not go there. And so we have this tension between what the court can actually rule upon without, in fact, by virtue of that ruling, delegitimise the very court that's making the law, or the capacity of our parliaments to then take that and give some shape, some political architecture to it, meaningful architecture, not just things like native title and extinguishment, but meaningful architecture that deal with the unresolved questions of sovereignty. And I think it goes to the heart of the Australian project that even worthy issues like Uluru, talk of truth-telling, are seen as rehabilitation projects, that we are in the business of rehabilitating the nation, but not fundamentally dealing with the question of extant rights. It is predicated on a reconciliation, a healing, but not dealing with those fundamental questions of rights, because they are not seated in our law in the way that they are in New Zealand or in Canada or in the United States. So as Henry points out, it makes it a very different settlement. The other thing I really wanted to go to was the sense of how these things connect on a global scale. And while there are differences in colonisation around the world, it is part of the project of modernity. Now, the idea of modernity, the idea of empire and colonisation, the assumptions that land could be claimed by other countries on the basis that they would deem that there was no recognisable system of law or civilisation there. The 200, 300 years of that Western post-Enlightenment hegemony, which is now being challenged in so many ways. You know, the rise of China is a direct challenge to what we see as a sort of Western-centered global modern project. China, of course, has been part of that project, and its entry into the global institutions like the World Health Organization, the World Trade Organization, and so on, have given shape to China's rise. But it challenges the centrality of Western hegemony. And that's a big adjustment for the world. And when you add to the fact China's authoritarianism only complicates that picture when you're trying to blend China with what's seen as a global liberal order. And this is creating a new fault line in our world. So it's a fault line vis-a-vis China and the West and that tussle for power. And then within the West, there are the other fault lines of race and class and history. Coronavirus has revealed the extent of disadvantage and inequality. The people who have suffered the most in COVID in the West have been the poor, the black and the brown, and the Indigenous peoples, the Black Lives Matter movement. These things are challenging the idea of the global liberal system and Western liberal order. So we are at a real pivot point. We are at a real pivot point. And questions are being asked about the resilience of liberal democracy, which is undoubtedly in retreat around the world. And I don't say that with any glee, but undoubtedly it is, vis-a-vis the rise of an authoritarian power in China, and the imperative that liberal states, the Western states who are the inheritors of this global modernity, get their own house in order. That if we are going to have a liberalism and a democracy that is able to resist what is an increasing authoritarian challenge, then it needs also to look to its own failings. And so Australia is at the heart of that. If we cannot, if our democracy cannot deal with the legacy of colonisation and the assumptions of the extinguishment of Indigenous rights, if we can't deal with that, then how do we make a virtuous case for the preservation of liberal democracy in the face of a rising authoritarian threat? And these are the real challenges of our age, and that centres very much at the heart of that, those questions of colonisation, empire, the legacy of history and racism. And I hope we do get them right, because there is much to preserve. You know, having lived in a lot of the most repressive countries on earth, I hope we do get them right. But this is a real challenge right now, right across the world.
Yeah, I think, Stan, you might have some stories to tell us about talking to people in countries that have been criticised by the Western Bloc for their repression of minorities or for their, you know, failure to observe human rights. And coming from, you know, settler states like Australia, the United States and Canada, where I'm going to use the word genocide, genocides occurred at the hands of the colonisers, surely it must be the case that these political entities or countries or, you know, political leaders who are criticised by the Western Bloc must be guffawing behind their hands.
Well, we see that, Marcia, don't we? Yeah.
Genocide.
We see that in China, for instance. I mean, China, which is accused right now of its own genocide, of the Uyghur Muslim population, immediately fires back. Well, look what you did. It attacks the United States for its legacy of slavery, genocide of First Nations people. It's levelled the similar accusations at Australia. Now, having lived in China for a very long time, the reality is there is no Uyghur Lives Matter movement in China. The right of association, the freedom of expression, the rule of law, there is no, you know, doesn't allow for the type of things that we've seen in our own countries that have challenged the idea of the legacy of racism and segregation. You know, the civil rights movement of the 60s in the United States, the Mabo case I've mentioned, the protest movements of the 60s and 70s in Australia that have prized open the door. We don't see that in countries like China, where there is an authoritarian grip on power. But it goes to my point, Marcia, that at a point in history where there is a definite fault line between an increasingly powerful authoritarianism and a democratic recession, the imperative that democratic states deal with those fundamental questions of their own legitimacy is at the forefront, because they are precisely the sort of criticism we're going to get from countries like China, and we are seeing that.
Yeah, I think it's urgent, isn't it? And I think most Australians feel that because of the truth-telling that's been done. I think there's a sentiment in this country that's ready to, you know, take a vast improvement of our democracy, which is to give our people, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, a fair voice about what happens to them here, you know, and that's a very important step that we need to take, and it's urgent.
And it makes the work of you, Thomas, and the work that you've done in supporting Uluru, it makes the work of people like you, Marcia, and I know it must be a terribly thankless task, and I know it must take a terrible toll year after year to keep finding the energy to do that, but it makes the work of people like Henry in excavating this history and telling these stories, not to engage in these phony or horribly negative culture wars, but as a way of saying, look, this is our history. And this may be a way forward, a proper account of that history on the one hand, and then the hope and the restorative power of things like Uluru or treaties that give some legitimacy to the nation, a legitimacy that is lacking while ever we don't deal with those things. And so That's the incredible work of people who've gone before us and the people who are here on this discussion today.
I might add there that I must say I was shocked when on the weekend there was a review of our book Tongalongata by Charles Woolley, and there were 350 comments.
Mm.
And 350 comments almost universally were talking of, and not the most people hadn't read the book quite obviously, they'd read the review, but they were angry. They were saying, why do you do this to make us feel guilty and feel bad about our country? This happens all over the world. Why pick on us? But above all, the central theme was, why dig up the past? Look to the future. And I was taken aback by just how many there were, which indicates that someone like me, I talk to people all over the place, but I'm talking to the converted.
Mm.
And there's clearly still a very, very large residue of people who are very hostile. And I think the Trump phenomenon is undoubtedly influencing Australia, which raises this question of the difficulty we're going to have, particularly if we want a referendum, which I think is essential. But the battle is still on. I mean, in a very real sense.
There's the polling that the campaign has done has shown that, the even through COVID in the last 12 months, there's been a continual rise in people that say they'd vote yes in a referendum. It's something like 60% now. But I think the really interesting thing is, that should preface this, but if part of it, I think, is that people are a bit tired of truth-telling, in that they know the truth somewhat, right?
They should try living with it.
And it's sort of like, well, it's time, so what are we... I mean, there's a big movement of people that are saying, how can we translate all this, all these 20 years of reconciliation and all the truth-telling into something tangible that fundamentally changes the DNA of the nation and brings us together. I think there's a strong sentiment that way too.
It's part of a sort of Australian character in a sense that too much historical introspection is seen as an indulgence. That it is a bit of, tied up with wire, let's get on with the job, let's keep... I mean, the idea that to talk about our history, to lay bare those truths, to hear other voices is somehow somehow an attack on our democracy, is somehow an attack on Australia. I go back to the earlier point that I made. The struggle of our people has been a struggle for a better country. People who could have had given up and had no hope in Australia have actually fought for a better Australia. I mean, this is the heavy lifting of democracy. If democracy is going to mean something, it surely comes from the voices of those who've been excluded, who say that we have a voice too and we can make the country a better country too. That's a consistent message we've heard from movements around the world. So, Henry, it's disturbing, isn't it, that you get those messages and that there is still that reflexive rejection of these things as somehow an attack on Australia rather than an expression. What a wonderful thing that we live in a country where you can publish books like that and we can have these discussions. That's a democracy.
And yeah. I have a question now. So, Henry, you have a bit to say in your book about Malcolm Turnbull's rejection of the Uluru Statement from the Heart, outright, almost instant rejection. And he apparently, I've read something in his writing recently that he remains opposed to the Indigenous voice and the other messages of the Uluru Statement from the Heart. And he claims that the voice would be a third chamber of Parliament. So you've mentioned that, Thomas, you've run into it. I'm sure you've covered it, Stan. So one of the questions in the Q&A is about, this point, what will it take to get parliamentarians, to get the Commonwealth to agree to a national treaty truth-telling voice process? It's not true that only Victoria has incorporated this. Victoria, Queensland and the Northern Territory have started treaty processes, but I think you would say, Thomas, that that's not sufficient. But anyway, what do we do about these parliamentarians? How do we respond to this flippant line from Malcolm Turnbull when he was Prime Minister, and which he maintains, and I think is very strongly supported by backbenchers.
Yes, I mean, the way he did it was profoundly insulting. I mean, it showed no respect for the gravity and the seriousness of the statement and the way it was put together and what was being offered. To do it so peremptorily, suddenly and rudely, and in a way we expected more of Turnbull. That is, he's one of the more clearly better educated, bright, middle-of-the-road liberal liberals, and we expected so much more of him. So that for the people who were there and put their heart and soul into the statement, it must have been profoundly hurtful.
And I think that it raises the problem of, you know, reparations for the past. I mean, Keating and Rudd achieved so much. Keating with his Redfern speech and the passage of the Native Title Act through Parliament, and Kevin Rudd with his apology to the Stolen Generations. These acts are in the nature of reparations for the past. And so too could the Indigenous voice be an act of reparation, the treaties as well, the truth-telling process. So, Stan, you must have a view on
that. Well, again, it comes back to the point I think I made earlier, Marcia, and that is that everything is predicated on the rehabilitation of the nation rather than the rights of the people of the nation. And so it's so easy to dismiss these things or to say that these things are illiberal. Like, we hear this argument as well, that this is somehow illiberal, that in a liberal democracy we don't make laws on the basis of race, or we don't have special categories of people. But, of course, that has been the story of our liberal democracy. They have always been, and we were the ones who were being so defined. We know that there are competing interest groups, and indeed there are political parties that represent sectional interests in Australia. So we can dispense with that idea. You know, what it is fundamentally is, to go back to Henry's original point, it is the exceptional nature of this settlement, this invasion. It is the exceptional nature of it, and the completeness of the extinguishment of those rights, which means that we can close the book on that and forever and a day never revisit that in a meaningful, substantial way. We can have reconciliation. We can have funding for closing the gap. We can have acknowledgements of country and welcomes to country. We can do all of the rehabilitative work, but we can't deal with the fundamental rights work, because that is not what is built into the DNA of our liberal democracy. And I just say to that is a fundamental lack of imagination. It's a fundamental lack of faith in the Australian people, who, when they've even asked to vote on these things, whether it be 1967 or when they have marched for reconciliation, the support that was shown after the national apology, when Thomas points to the ongoing support in principle for something like a voice in the Constitution, that it is a failure and a lack of faith in those people, in the Australian people as well. So there is a roadblock here. There is a roadblock between where the public may be able to go, where the truth-telling may lead us, where the national reconciliation at a personal and social level may take us, and the ability of our legal structure and our political class to act on that and give it the appropriate political architecture. It's so easy to rule it out of bounds, a third chamber, illiberal, out of step with Australian democracy. It is so easy to do that rather than examine the fundamental question: is if it is out of step with our democracy, how do we change that? That's our question, and we shy away from it time and again.
That's a great point. How do we change it? I mean, I think, you know, talking about the hopelessness, I'd just like to go to a a bit of hope here. When I talked about that rise in numbers of people that say that they will vote yes in a referendum, even through a pandemic, even without a well-resourced campaign, I mean, it indicates this momentum that we have, you know, that hasn't faltered through these times, and that, you know, the people need to put pressure on the politicians. You know, it's just the normal way that democracies work. If all of the converted that are here listening now, you know, want change, then they need to get into the politicians' ears. They need to spread the word. They need to encourage others to get into their ears, you know. And we've got momentum there as well. There are some coalition people that support exactly what we're talking about in the United Statement across the political spectrum.
So I think we might be out of time, but nobody's put out the big hook and yanked me off the stage yet.
People would find that very difficult to do to you, Marcy.
Going for a bit longer. I wonder if there isn't, you know, amongst the Malcolm Turnbulls and, you know, these backbenchers who have some, you know, very flaky arguments about these matters, if there isn't, in fact, you know, an enormous insecurity about this concept of Australia and Australia Day and the monumentalisation and memorialisation of colonists. I mean, your use of that quote, Henry, this whispering in our hearts, you know, I think there must be a deep-seated sense of insecurity, a deep-seated sense of the injustice and wrong, and, you know, and yet, you know, they all put on their brave face and continue to assert what is fundamentally an idea of white Australia. You know, they pay lip service to multicultural Australia, but Australia Day has become even more, I think, white Australia being represented. You know, they wheel out their citizenship, you know, ceremonies. But, you know, some awful stuff goes on at these citizenship ceremonies. And you know, behind the scenes, you know, how do you become an Australian? You have to answer questions about Don Bradman.
Yes. Yes, indeed. And, I mean, the three important days that conservative Australians want to remark is the voyage of Cook up the East Coast, the arrival of the British in 1788, and Anzac. Now, they are all imperial events. They all, you know, they all are, it's as though they are saying nothing that happened in Australia is as important about what the British did and what we did for the British on the other side of the world. It is a very, very strange thing that we can't even decide when what we want to commemorate, when we want to commemorate it, and if we have ever really become independent.
And I really wish we had more time to talk about your point about honouring the Aboriginal warriors who fought the British. You know, Anzac Day is such a big deal. But I believe in Tasmania there's now a movement, and in fact there has been one ceremony where the warriors, like the man you write about,
Tonga Longata, yep,
have been honoured. For the first time in an Anzac Day ceremony. You know, I wish we had time to talk about that, but Thomas, would you like to say something, given that you've written the hopeful intergenerational letter to your son and asked other Indigenous men to do so? You know, that is, your book looks forward, tries to create a better world, so I'll leave the final word to you.
Thanks, Marcia. I think I might just read the acknowledgement in the book, Dear Son. It might be an appropriate way of closing on that note, I think. It goes, Dear First Nations men, together we will unlearn what we were taught in the colonisers' missions, slave camps, prisons, ghettos, and in the Australian media. We will sing our culture, healing the earth, as our grandfathers did for more than 60 millennia. We will love ourselves and our families, and we'll return to our rightful place in Australia. We will celebrate who we are as we have always deserved to do, in unity.
Thank you.
Thanks. Tom.
That was very special. So, again, they still have not yanked me off the stage.
Hey, mate.
That's more good manners than anything, guys.
Well, how about, well, they will. I mean, they'll just turn us all off. Why don't we just keep going until they turn us off?
Why not?
I am really interested in this question of, you know, how the nation is formed through Australia Day, Anzac Day, memorials to colonists. You know, say, for instance, there are statues in so many places in Australia of Matthew Flinders, and yet not a single one of the Aboriginal man who went with him in circumnavigating Australia and made it possible for him to make it all the way around the country. Henry, what's his name? I've forgotten his name.
Yes, I know exactly who you mean, but I'm of an age where it's very hard to pick up names quickly. I'm sorry.
Yeah, me too.
Migiyo, Bunduri and Bundle, yeah?
Say it again.
Migiyo, Bunduri and Bundle or Bundle. I'm just looking at this book here. I think it's about the same thing.
Yeah. So, Henry, you've got a few views about these statues. I thought the way you talked about the Rhodes statues was very enlightening.
Yes, and the way in which, yesterday was Columbus Day, what used to be Columbus Day all over the Americas, and in so many places it is no longer Columbus Day. It's the day for the indigenous people. And Mexico has the Day of the Races, when it's a celebration of all the, all the Indian heritage. And this whole turning around of both North and South America in relation to the European discovery, I think, is symptomatic of what's going on all over the world.
But it's still, Marcia, I see you've been given the hook now. They've told you we've got to wrap up. But again, it goes to the idea that to raise questions about this heritage and this history is somehow seen as being an attack on Australia. And I remember a couple of years ago when I dared to write about the Captain Cook statue and the inscription that still reads, "Discovered this territory in 1770. Our courts don't even support that idea. And yet was accused of being effectively a member of the Taliban who wants to tear down everything that's good and holy in Australia. You know, we need to be able to have those conversations. We need to be able to challenge that. We need to bring those other voices to bear. We need to be a strong enough democracy to be able to do that without cringing against that or seeing everything as an attack. There has to be a way to have this conversation.
I find it incomprehensible that a man like Bunbury, who accompanied Matthew Flinders around Australia, does not have any memorial in his honour. So, you know, we're taught in school Matthew Flinders was the first person to circumnavigate Australia. Well, no, he wasn't actually.
Mm.
He was one of the two people who circumnavigated Australia. The other person was Bunbury.
Mm.
And we never learned about him in school, did we?
No.
Just, how can it possibly be contentious? But no, they can't even admit that. There isn't even a memorial to him. He was born in Broken Bay in 1775, I believe. So
I think all the first step to all of these changes that we're talking about that we need is to give us the power. You know, it comes to exactly what Stan was talking about. You know, give us the power, the rights to be able to speak for ourselves and speak strongly and choose our own representatives.
And I think deep in each one of your books, there's this idea of Aboriginal sovereignty that's very sophisticated and but still yet beyond the ken of people like Malcolm Turnbull. So I urge our audience members to read these wonderful books by these wonderful authors, because I think the future of Australia depends on people understanding the messages in these books. From Henry, Stan and Thomas, thank you so much for joining us. I've enjoyed it enormously, and keep writing. I need to have something to read. Okay. Thank you very, very much.
Marcia.
The audience.
Thank you. Thank you to you, yep. Marcia. Nice to see you both. Henry.
Yes. Thank you.
Respect to you.
That was That was very good. Yes.
Good night.
Thanks for listening. To support Melbourne Writers Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.